In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to the Friday edition of Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is the interview, and I am delighted to be bringing it to you at the end of this short week. I don't know about you. I find bank holiday weeks harder in many ways than normal weeks because work just doesn't, I mean, for me anyway, it doesn't work anymore. Like if you have a day off, you have a day off. It just means you have to do 5 days worth of work in four. Anyway. I won't go on about that. I'm very glad to be at the end of this week, and I hope you are too. I hope you've had a good one, but if not, no worries. That's behind us now. I am delighted. Thank you so much to all of you who have already bought tickets for the Laughter Lounge. I've announced a live show in the Laughter Lounge on May 9th. Really looking forward to that. It is going to be, if you like the podcast, you'll like it. Like the plan is to kind of lean in, certainly at least in part, to the laughter part of the Laughter Lounge name. So I think we're going to have a lot of fun. And I'm really excited about it. I would love to see you there. Tickets are available now. I'll put the link in the show notes. And other than that, no major news for me in the 2 days since I last spoke to you. What did I do? Oh, I went last night, actually. I went to the launch of Jennifer Rock's skincare brand, Skingredients, new product. I don't know if you guys know Jennifer Rock. She's also known as the Skin Nerd. Obviously, I write a beauty column for the Irish Independent Weekend magazine, and I love beauty. So I very much have my ear to the ground when it comes to new stuff in beauty and old stuff as well. But Jennifer Rock is honestly, I think, one of the most credible and trustworthy people in beauty in Ireland. And when she launched Skingredients, it was about 5 years ago, I think, she launched it with the core four, she calls it, with the four products, skincare products, which kind of covered most of the bases that you would require when it comes to your skin. And then she hasn't released anything new since then. And so when she did announce that she was doing a new product, I knew it was going to be a big deal because, you know, to make money in beauty, people are pumping out new products all the time because that's how you get press coverage. That's how you get TikToks made about you. That's how you get attention, basically, is with new. And you'll see that there are some brands that seem to have a new product out every 2 months. Charlotte Tilbury, I'm looking at you. And I'm not saying that I don't like a lot of those products. I do, but like the pace can be pretty frenzied. Whereas, you know, Jennifer spent 4 years developing this new product, which is a retinol. Well, it's a retinol in two strengths. So I guess it's kind of two products, a 0.6% and a 1% retinol. And I've been using it for a while. I actually think it's really great. I really like Jennifer on a personal level. This isn't an ad at all. Like no money has been exchanged. She hasn't asked me to do this, but I just really like and trust her. And it was great to go and celebrate that new product with her last night. excuse me. If you don't use retinol, and you're a woman of a certain age or a man of a certain age or a non-binary person of a certain age, and you are concerned about your skin, you don't have to be. You don't owe anybody eternal youth or pretty or anything else. But if you are someone who would like to spend your life working toward having the skin of a baby infant like me, retinol is definitely something you should consider having in your routine. But this is not the place for that. That's the beauty column. That's where that lives. But that's the main thing that I've done between the last time I spoke to you and now, aside from work. Anyway, let's get into this interview. So I was really happy to speak to Mark Megan about his new book. It is called This Is Not a Self-Help Book, But It Might Just Help You. It came through my door a few months ago and I picked it up one day kind of casually and I ended up reading almost the entire thing in one go. It's not the kind of book that I would normally gravitate toward. I don't tend to like anything that feels kind of inspirational, even though sometimes I'm wrong about it and sometimes I miss out on really good stuff that way. But I just found this book really frank and raw and honest in a way that was very moving. And I was excited to talk to Mark. Now, I want to be very clear about this conversation because I started it in the wrong way. So Mark is going out with Dearon Garrahy. Sorry, is engaged to Dearon Garrahy. And I know Dearon from 2FM, obviously, from work. So I said at the start, you'll hear, it does not go down well. I basically say, I wasn't familiar with you before this. I only knew you as Dearon's fella. But I meant that more as in Dearon, a person I know, as opposed to Dearon, the very, very famous person. And obviously, Mark does not want to be branded Dearon Garrahy's fella in his normal life. So he was like, oh no, she's going to talk about Dearon now in this whole conversation. And that wasn't my plan. So I set it off in the wrong way. I messed it up, guys. I messed it up, but I'm keeping it in. I could have edited it out, but I'm not. I'm going to keep it in because I think what happens is really interesting. Myself and Mark have a great conversation. And what comes up in that conversation is something that I've actually never heard anybody else verbalize, aside from the important stuff that we talk about, because Mark's book is about his experience with addiction. And he speaks about it in a really, I think, helpful and frank way. I think when we hear about addiction, we generally think about it as being something that, you know, happens in older people's lives, but it's not. And, Mark was very young when he had to come to terms with the fact that he needed to give up on drugs and drink. But anyway, there's a point where me and Mark acknowledge something that happens that I experience and I had never spoken about before. And that is the feeling of self-consciousness when you are speaking, even like for me speaking now, or if I'm speaking on my Instagram stories, or if I'm doing an interview, it's knowing that what you say may be taken out of context and turned into a story on another website or in another newspaper. It doesn't really happen to me anymore, actually. I think since I left RTE, the newspapers aren't interested in me anymore, which is absolutely fine with me. Sometimes you would have a conversation with a journalist, and they would write a lovely piece and it would be very much, you know, on the basis of what you spoke about and the tone of the conversation. But then another journalist or someone online might take one sentence from that and turn that into something really scandalous, take it out of context. And then all of a sudden it's, you know, this big, horrible story where the spotlight is shone on one comment that you made in 5 seconds. And, you know, then your whole family's upset because it's about them and you didn't even realize you'd said anything about them. And, it's just this thing that can spiral. And the result of that, I've seen it happen with so many of my friends as well. And the result of that is that you start to become very self-conscious and guarded. And it's very hard to have a normal conversation or just go on your Instagram stories and be normal. By the way, people's comments as well feed into this. Like for me on social media, people sending you mean comments, you start to edit yourself and you can't be as kind of frank and honest as you maybe initially were. And, you know, that might have been the very thing that kind of attracted people to you. But now all of a sudden you don't feel like you can be yourself. It's a weird, weird thing of this bizarre world that we live in of having like a minor profile. As I said, people aren't really interested in me anymore aside from my people who I love, our community here and the like. And that's a much better place to be actually for me. And I much prefer that. But anyway, I think it's interesting to hear the conversation between myself and Mark and hear us settle into it and become comfortable with each other. And Mark acknowledged that tension there, that self-consciousness that he has as a result of having had those experiences before. But we do also obviously get to what's in the book, and what's in the book is important. And I think that if you're someone who's maybe in the early days of acknowledging that you might have a problem with drugs or alcohol, I think you'll find it helpful. I think you would find the book helpful, genuinely. As he says, as the title says, it's not a self-help book. It's not an instructional manual at all. And Mark, really is at great pains to point out that his experience is just one person's experience. He's not an expert. He doesn't claim to be. He's just, he thought that his experience might be helpful to other people. And I think it will, because I think that particularly if you're a young person, it can be very hard to face up to the fact that unfortunately you don't respond to booze in the same way as your friends. And that while maybe your friends can have a few drinks, you just can't. I think that that's a really hard thing to confront and come to terms with. And I think that Mark's book might help you with that. Anywho, I have now babbled on for almost 9 minutes. I am terribly sorry. Let's get into the interview.
Well, Mark, I'm going to be totally honest with you because that is the way of me, and say that I was not familiar with you until I learned of you through Dearen. Is that a terrible thing to say? Is that something that you're encountering a lot these days?
Some people, yeah. I mean, like, Dearen's, you know, hugely successful. So there are lots of people that will only be hearing about me due to the exposure of being in a relationship with her. So no, that's not... It's not strange by any means.
Well, obviously, I worked with Dearen, so I keep an eye on her, as many other people do in this world of social media. But the reason that I wanted to contextualize this is because I wanted to say that, because then I hope you'll believe me when I say that when I read your book, I was so incredibly impressed. I didn't know anything about you or your career or what you'd done up to this point. But I sat down and started reading your book, and I read it essentially in one sitting, which is not something that happens for me very often. I have ADHD, so focus is not my strong suit. So I was coming in kind of completely, you know, neutral, if you know what I mean. And I was so impressed by it. So maybe you can start by telling people who haven't read the book or who maybe aren't familiar with you, what is the book about?
So I suppose the book is about self-discovery, really, largely. Centering around my addiction to alcohol and also drugs, which until I came into recovery, I didn't think I had a drug problem, to be brutally honest. I only thought that, and I still doubted whether or not I had an alcohol problem. And on my bad days, I still doubt whether or not I have an alcohol problem, you know?
Well, that's the way of the beast, isn't it?
That's it. It's... some people say that it's the only disease where it tells you that you don't have it. But I think from what I've heard from other people who've suffered with eating disorders, that might fall into that category as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
So the book is, it's basically me navigating my way through the early days of sobriety, reconciling with that monumental change in life. But then in order to get to there, I have to document, I suppose, the things that brought me to recovery, aka drinking alcoholically and misusing drugs. And that in itself is the loose premise of the book, but within it, within those chapters, it's about me ultimately trying to discover and build a relationship with myself.
And why did
I didn't really have one, you know. I didn't have a good relationship with myself whenever I stopped drinking.
What made you write the book?
I felt I was around 18 months sober, and I felt like I had one foot in my old life and one foot in the new life. And I mean, I'm a comedian, and you know, lots of my content was me roasting things on Instagram. And I just felt, strange. I felt like, oh, this is just so surface level versus what's actually going on in my life. And there's this huge, massive thing of being in recovery. And I also struggled a lot with, you know, lots of people think that once you put the drink down that you're off to the races. Do you know what I mean? And life just falls into the place, and sure, X person doesn't drink anymore. Because I suppose... for non-alcoholics, the idea of not drinking isn't probably that big a deal, you know. It's, or, you know, people get pregnant, they stop drinking for however many months, you know. These things happen. People have medical conditions, you know. So I found myself in this weird place after 18 months where, as I say, I was just in this limbo, and I had so much inside me that I felt like I wasn't tapping into, and therapy wasn't really helping. And sorry, therapy was absolutely helping, but in regards to getting out this sort of mess that was inside me, I just needed to write. And I mean, like, look, I've always written since I was a child, you know, be it music, be it poetry, be it songs, be it comedy, obviously. And then I needed to connect with some sense of, I don't know, blurs it all out and figure out where I am and I suppose who I am now. That's not to say that I have figured out who I am. You know, that's the lifelong journey, I suppose. But it really helped.
Yeah. I have to say, like, I've written a book and I write as well. And I think that blurting it all out kind of writing when it comes to this kind of experiential stuff is so, I think, is some of the best writing, because it's really true. It's not something that you've, and I'm not suggesting that it's easy, but like, it's not something that you have to kind of really work to choose the right words, because it just kind of comes out of you. Was that your experience of writing this then?
I still find it tough, to be honest, because I have to, you know, when writing about addiction, for me, I have to look at what voice is doing the writing. Do you know what I mean? And it's also it's a line that I wanted to tread carefully. And it's even why I'm probably a little bit guarded on this call, you know, is because my biggest fear would be that I come across like I'm speaking for other alcoholics, or I'm speaking to anybody else's experience other than my own, or that just because I am an alcoholic, that gives me some form of, you know, profound insight into addiction that other, like, you know, that gives me, I don't have an authority. And I mentioned that in the book, like, I'm not an authority on addiction. I'm not an authority on alcoholism. It's purely my experience. But even within that, I did want to be careful, because like, I didn't want to upset anybody. And I also, you know, I didn't want to upset people that I know who care about me. So, you know, it's easy on the bad days. I can very easily slip into self-pity mode. And I wanted to make sure when writing this book that that was not the case, that this isn't just a woe is me, because everybody has their own shit. And on a daily basis, I talk to people whose problems utterly dwarf that fact that they cannot have a drink that day. So, you know, I also wanted to write with the perspective of like, this is my shit. Things were really bad. Things are better, but it's not the be all and end all. It's not the answer. There, you know,
well,
it's just some experiences.
I think you really succeed with that, though. It doesn't feel like a pity party. It doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like you think that you're somehow like, you know, unique or special in this experience. Like, it comes across. I think you really have succeeded in that, is what I'm saying.
Thank you.
So obviously, for people who haven't read the book, at what stage did you first think that drinking might have been a problem for you?
I'm pretty sure early on in my 20s. Well, sorry, I know the first time I took action, I was 18. I had moved to Brighton. It's so young. And I didn't realize, of course, I didn't at the time when I was 18. I thought I was, you know, the man who knew the world. I knew everything. And that's when I moved to Brighton to study music. And I was drinking every day and just beer, but it was becoming problematic. And I was drinking to, other times in my teens, I was drinking to enhance feelings. I was drinking to feel more connected, to feel more like a belong part of a group, to be able to dance at a disco, you know, to be able to wrap my arms around one of the lads and sing a song, and just to lose those inhibitions and to feel like I was part of every, that, you know, as I frequently mentioned this, everybody, to feel like I was one of everybody. Whereas when I went to Brighton, I was drinking to counter a feeling. You know, and that's sort of the medicinal element, where rather than drinking to enhance, you're drinking to sort of shut down the racing mind and the thoughts and the worries and whatever. And it was around, I was maybe 3 or 4 months in, and that's sort of, I was having panic attacks by day, effectively, and then drinking by night. But again, it wasn't all the doldrums. Like, I was still doing normal, inverted commas, teenage things, you know, so it could be mistaken for just normal uni partying. And I went to the doctor and I sort of said, listen, I think I've got a drinking problem. I'm drinking every day. I can't stop. And that's the thing that scared me, was that I would say I want to stop, and then I wouldn't do that. And so even if I was only having a few beers, it's the fact that it was every day, I'd say, well, I'm not going to do that tonight. Yeah. But then, you know, mysteriously, it would happen. So I went to the doctor, I told him, he said to me, listen, you know, there's lots of stuff that I think we should talk about and that you need to maybe work on. I don't necessarily think you're an alcoholic yet. And of course, you know, I was off to the races. That word yet stalked me for 15 years afterwards, you know, there was always a yet. As long as something hadn't happened yet, you know, I was okay, because the girlfriend hadn't left me, I hadn't lost the job, or I hadn't done this, or I hadn't that. But once one thing would happen, it would just shift again.
Yeah.
So that's when I was 18. And then that just, I embarked on a journey of am I or am I not? Am I or am I not? For literally, well, okay, so 18 till 31. I'm so bad at maths. 13 years? Is that, like 12 or 13 years of constantly dealing with this, am I or am I not? And it's you know, one of the things that I laugh about with alcoholics is that, you know, normal people, they don't do this. They don't set off on a quest to perpetually prove to themselves that they are not alcoholic. Because that's the obsession. You know, normal, inverted commas, people aren't consumed by the amount of alcohol and when the alcohol is coming, when they last had it. The fact that it's now been 36 hours since I've had a drink. Look at how great I am. I'm not an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink since Friday. If I was an alcoholic, I would have drank on Saturday. Yeah. But I was able to do this. And, you know, all of these permanent, like, not rules, but loopholes, gymnastics to try and figure out and justify to continue drink. Like, it all, I get a bit messed up when I talk about it, but it all just comes to reasons to keep me drinking.
Yeah.
You know?
And that is, I mean, that is how it continues. And I was really impressed by, you don't hold back. Like, you know, it doesn't seem like, which I think is a, you know, a sign of how well you're doing in your recovery, that you, sorry, I have a lot of experience with alcoholism in my life, not me personally, but in my family. And I've been through a lot of therapy and I've been to a lot of treatment centers to support people in my life. So I'm not an expert at all by any stretch, but I know a little bit. And for me, the fact that you were so honest in the book about some of the situations that you found yourself in or the situations you created for yourself, you know, was a really positive indicator of how your recovery is going. Because, you know, in my experience, sometimes people can really struggle to face up to the reality of what happened when they were drinking.
Thank you. I think it's important for me, selfishly. I think it's most important for me to write down those embarrassing, shameful, ugly, ugly sides, because on the day that, on the days that that doubt creeps in, I just have to remember, okay, do you think that that is normal drinking, Mark? Do you think if you go back out, you're going to be able to be normal? You know, and I try and be as rigorously honest as possible when it comes to the things that I did to protect myself from the illusion that another drink is a good idea, but also that there are probably other people out there who find themselves in that sort of gray, and I keep saying it, but gray area of addiction, wherein they're not without a home or they're not on the street, and that's what they're relying on. They're relying on the, and I'm embarrassed at how archaic my thinking was, you know, about alcoholism for so much of my life as a practicing alcoholic. But, you know, I really did believe that it took a park bench with a paper bag. And that's the only version of alcoholism that I knew. And I think when I wrote this book, and I'm not going to lie to you, because I'm sort of freezing up talking about it now, because since I spoke about it publicly, there was then a number of other articles written about it and written in ways which are clearly just thinly veiled attempts to shame me.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I struggle now to be silent about that because I think it's dangerous. Yeah. I think it's really, really dangerous when somebody does open up to then capitalize on the sensationalist elements of what they've opened up about and use that to guard our attention and clicks. I think it's subhuman, but to be less of the pity party, I think it's important.
Well, no, I think, sorry to pause there, because I actually think it is good to confront that, because, you know, anybody who's in the public eye in any way in Ireland has probably had this experience of talking about something in one context and then having little bits of the story taken out and created into something else for a newspaper or a website or whatever. And you don't have to be famous. Like, I remember the first time it happened to me, I was like, who cares? Like, no one cares about this. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not important enough to warrant this kind of nonsense. But it is a thing that happens and it's not okay, because as you say, you know, it is very generous to be honest and vulnerable and share your experience. And then when people take advantage of that, it's actually really not cool. Do you think, though, I think that most people our age are literate enough with the media that they understand that things are sensationalized. But what for me, it was worry about like older members in my family who might see things.
This is it.
Yeah.
This, like, Louise, that's it exactly. And the worst thing is that, like, there are people out there who are directly responsible for literally on some of my bad days, keeping me afloat, and not just keeping me away from a drink, but keeping me like
alive,
you know, just in one alive. Yeah. And if I was to see then, if the idea of them reading something that looks like I ran to the papers with some sort of sensationalist bullshit tell all,
yeah,
it rots me to, like, to my core. Do you know what I mean? It's, you can hear it in my voice. It brings up so much, like, just, I suppose, a dismay that somebody, there's a human being out there willing to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a human sitting at their desk going, bang, let's go. And then also just the fact that there are other people currently suffering who will go, well, well, good luck. No thanks. If, you know, but I suppose I, you know, I chose to come forward about this. And I also chose to mention those, you know, some of the other dirtier, like, problematic, seemingly at the time, small things, but that ultimately are very significant, you know, aspects of cocaine use. And let's call it out. Like, that's the elephant in the room here that I'm even avoiding. Like, I'm still embarrassed about cocaine because I feel like I'm comfortable talking to you about alcoholism. I'm comfortable introducing to myself to strangers as an alcoholic. But when cocaine comes into the fray, I'm still mortified because I'm like, I feel dirty.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's why I force myself to just push through that, like, awkwardness and shame and write about it, because there, we know cocaine is everywhere. Like, we know cocaine is everywhere. Like, every week there's a new article saying, oh, cocaine in the GAA clubs, cocaine in the rugby clubs, the sports hall. Show me somewhere that cocaine isn't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And, you know, we know that there's a mental health crisis in the, in this country. Okay. Throw some cocaine into that mix and just see what happens. And that's why, like, those mortifying things about, you know, my behavior and doing coke and stuff, I think it's vital, because when I was doing coke and I was floundering and I was drowning, I still didn't stop. And I thought, like, my behavior, again, was unique to me. I thought, I am particularly fucked up, or I am weird. I'm even getting drug addiction wrong. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not like others. And isolation is what kept me drinking. And, if, you know, that withdrawing and feeling different and feeling like I don't belong and feeling misunderstood, and having, since I came into recovery, talking to other people and other people speaking these desperate unspoken things, I'm not phrasing this well, but people articulating my darkest thoughts that I've held for my entire life, that's what sets me free.
Yeah. I think you're articulating that very well. I totally understand that. That's that idea of shared experience, I never shut up about it because it's so unbelievably powerful. But it's the hardest thing to do when your shared experience is something horrific or something terrifying or something really dark. Like, it's very hard to say those things out loud. And it's not understating it to say that in saying those things out loud, you can really help other people. That is a fact. I mean, like, that has been proven over and over and over again. So I completely understand why it's so important for you to talk. But I also do understand that you would have a self-consciousness about it, because I know what it feels like to give an interview and also be thinking, how is this going to be taken out of context now and turned into something else? And I actually think it's good that you've confronted it here in this conversation, because I get it. And I know my just to honestly sing the praises of the people who listen to this podcast, they are the best. So everyone who's here in this listening experience with us is going to completely understand where you're coming from. And I hope there's some comfort in that, even though we can't control what happens beyond that, you know?
Of course. Thank you.
So I feel like I totally get your motivation in writing the book now. Obviously, you feel you've benefited so much from other people sharing their experience that you want to give a little bit back. And I think that's incredible. But I also think it is worth confronting the fact that cocaine is everywhere, and also that drinking to a problematic extent is also very common in this country. And look, I love a drink, and I'm not going to pretend like I'm a perfect person who never has gone too far with stuff. But, like, I think I worry sometimes that our attitude, and I worry about my own drinking as well. Like, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but I do think that I probably drink a little bit too much. And I think that that is so common in Ireland that you can probably hide within that as an alcoholic. Do you think that that's true?
I think, see, it's really, it's one that I think a lot about. And often people ask me about growing up, you know, and they say, with the culture of youth drinking in Ireland, Mark, you know, you talk about going into fields and drinking naggins of vodka before you even were fully, you know, gone through puberty. And yeah. certainly that was my experience. Mm. And, you know, drinking just because everybody else was. And it would be seductive and tempting at times for me to look at the culture of Ireland and use that in the sort of arsenal of excuses as to why I drank. But then to counter that, you know, my best friends that I also drank with in those fields, they're not alcoholics.
Yeah, I suppose more what I mean is if you are an alcoholic within the culture, can you use that to kind of convince yourself that actually you're fine because everybody's doing it?
Yeah, I certainly did. Yeah. It's very easy to surround. And I mentioned this in the book. I say I hid my drinking in plain sight. Mm. And that's what I was. I was almost like arrogant about it because I thought I was staying one step ahead of the game. Mm. If I was drinking alcoholically, I'd be hiding it, you know, whereas the fact that I was just going out, I was socializing, you know, all of my life was just going to gigs, going to, you know, work things, you know, I was in entertainment. So it was all just like events and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought I'm just part of, this is the industry. It's not me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was very easy. And yeah, like heavy drinking is people drink heavily all the time in Ireland and the UK, you know? Mm.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So before I there's so much I want to ask you, but I suppose we should confront kind of what happened that made you eventually say, this is a problem I need to deal with.
Sure. I from around 2018 I started trying to get sober myself. I wasn't telling people I had a problem. I would just get sober for a week and I'd go swimming every day, go running. And I'd be telling literally people in supermarkets, oh, I'm sober, I haven't drank in a week, you know, look at how great I am. And that like sort of was a hamster wheel, which lasted for, 3 years, you know, where I'd get sober for a week, 10 days, then I'd go out in the piss and I'd lose another 6 weeks. And then I'd go back into another week. And it's this just constant, as I say, hamster wheel of regret and then repeat. Then in 20, like the efforts to get sober became more amplified as the problems became more grave internally as well as externally. Like I was becoming sloppy and it was becoming a mess. And as somebody said, it might not necessarily be always a problem when you drink, but all of your problems come from when you drink. And that was my situation, you know. It's not. I was still clinging on with my fingernails to this idea that, well, I went out last Tuesday and nothing happened. So, see, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. But that just kept ramping up and ramping up. And then I found myself back in Dublin in 2020, just before COVID, but then for the duration of COVID, and I on again, off again, relationship with alcohol, doing my best to get sober. And then it became tougher then because I'd be telling so many people that I was getting sober that then I'd have to try and tell them why I'm back drinking and make it all sound okay. Yeah. And that requires so much effort as well, the convincing, oh, no, it's fine. And, you know, I see somebody at a party and he go, man, you told me that you were like really, really struggling 2 weeks ago. What's going on here? Why are you walking? Why are you heading into the Jacks at 9 o'clock at a party when you said you were sober now?
Yeah.
So that was tough. And then I did try. I went to an addictions counselor, who I lied to. You know, I went to a therapist who I lied to. And just told them again that I was stressed. It was COVID. I was just drinking, you know, the odd here and there. Just everyone's drinking at home because of COVID. And then would say just enough for them to go, okay, well, it doesn't sound like things are that bad just yet. And then that would be my passport to continue on.
And it's funny because there will be people who will find that hard to understand because, you know, logically, why would you take yourself to an addiction counselor and then lie? But I understand it. What you want is that you're not an alcoholic response. So that's what you're trying to get. But you still have the actual fear that, you know, inside, deep inside, somehow you know that you are. But it's the addiction, isn't it, that kind of plays tricks on you?
Yeah, it's that voice. On the Monday morning, it's very easy to say, I'll do anything, you know. You can section me away from society. I will do anything to never drink again. But by Thursday evening, when the sun is shining and that's when the actual appointment is booked, all of a sudden, am I actually an alcoholic? A few of the guys are drinking in the park this evening. This idea of like, I look at my phone and everyone I talk to is going out drinking that night. And I go, who am I to sever myself away from all of my friends and family? And in fact, maybe that's the answer. Maybe I just need to be more social and it's the drinking at home that's the problem. It's COVID. Maybe if I was actually around people all the time, I wouldn't be lonely. I wouldn't be, you know.
Yeah.
And that just goes on forever. So then to get to the final drink, as it were, I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, I go through all of those experiences in the book and some of the more harrowing ones. And then it is rough.
You can feel, like reading it, you can feel the struggle. Like I just really felt for you. Like, and you know, you could feel the self-loathing that was there, you know, when you were trying and failing. And, you know, I think it's really important that people remember people. I think sometimes people think about addiction in very black and white terms. And I think it's really important that people understand what actually happens. And and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you about this book, because like, it is important that people understand that it's not easy. And you can really want it and still not manage to achieve it. So anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, you're okay. I think the self-discussed piece is really important. And it takes a long while to recover from carrying that level of self-discussed on a very daily basis. And I still am, you know. I can very easily, even now with the book, like I can very easily slip into, what am I doing? And like, I feel a bit too exposed. So I get defensive. What am I doing? I'm embarrassing myself. I should be ashamed of myself. Who the hell am I to start talking, you know?
Yeah.
And all of those thoughts, by the way, if uninterrupted, and if I let those run for long enough, that will bring me to, you're better off. You're better off drinking.
Yeah.
You know, now, fortunately, there's a structure in place now that I can get to it pretty early on, but it doesn't make it comfortable. And like, that's, I think certainly some people, you know, the idea would be just fucking stop. If you keep making such a mess of your life, just stop.
Yeah, it's a choice. It's a choice. Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas I hated myself. Like, I would wake up and I would look in the mirror and I would say, stop. Like, I'd scream at myself going, stop doing this. You have to stop. It's not going to happen again. And then it happens again. And you're looking at the same face in the mirror when you're in the bathroom and you're off your head. And deep down, there's a voice going, this isn't good. This isn't good. Mm. What goes up must come down. And lo, it comes down again. So then I was, to go back to nearing the end, you know, I was doing these self-imposed bouts of sobriety, which were like, as I say, I was wearing sobriety like a straitjacket. It was awful, where I didn't have any concept of addiction other than just stop. White knuckle it, stop doing what you're doing, like literally whipping myself, you know, you need to function in society without drinking. So just go out there and do it. Mm. And that was like the darkest. I mean, I was better off drinking. I would have been better off drinking than being that person, because I was bitter. I was paranoid. I was like angry, like so, so angry at myself, at the world around me. And then I also just thought, like, what is life? How is anybody able for this life without a drink? At least then, you know, this is my mind at the time, at least drinking gives me a respite from all of this shit, you know, at least I can get away from it all. Whereas this is just unbearable. And then, you know, so I drank again, because that's what I do. And it's sort of like, it's at that stage, it's not a choice. It's just that it's my response to dealing with life.
Yeah.
You know, my instinct is to drink, whether it's a good feeling, whether it's a bad feeling, whether it's a Monday, whether it's a Friday, it doesn't matter. It's like my response to life is to drink, to enhance or to silence or to distort or to warp or to bring excitement or to make it quieter. That's what I do. So I drank again, and I sent myself into oblivion. I was at a wedding, which was actually, by the way, a gorgeous wedding. And, you know, it was not by any means a crazy wedding. It was gorgeous. Like, my lovely little cousin's wedding. And I was just in my own head, and I got lost in it for the weekend. And I woke up, well, as I say, I didn't wake up because I didn't sleep, but I went to bed finally at 6 or 7 in the morning, and laid there tossing and turning and pleading and begging and borrowing with anybody that I could think of in my head to give me some sleep. And then I just started crying, and I was like, I'm done. It's a weird defeat. It's a very, it was like a spiritual defeat of, I am fucking, and to be totally candid, not I'm done drinking, I'm done being Mark.
Mm.
I'm done with Mark's sort of blueprint of living.
Yeah.
That's the end of it now. Like, that's where I am. It's, it's the darkest feeling wherein everything, your entire life, like my entire life had been leading to this, the fucking, excuse my language, like this unending series of excuses and justifications and reasons and blame and this toxic relationship or that, or it was her fault or it was his fault, or the job or the success or the lack of success or the desire for success. And just to give up and go, I'm done. It's me. I'm done. I can't do it.
Yeah,
can't do this anymore. And it was the first time that I was willing, you know, and I talk about this in the book in terms of, like, in order to change, it's not about doing the same stuff, but doing it harder or better or more efficiently. It's about doing it differently, you know, and for so long. And it's still the same, by the way, with, say, like with food stuff that I struggle with, you know, in terms of binging and eating bad food and dieting and then trying to lose weight and then whatever, putting on weight. I keep falling into this trap of, no, this week I'm just going to do all the same stuff, but I'm going to do it better. Mm. It's like, no, it's about doing it differently, you know? Yeah. And that day, I do believe, was the luckiest day of my life, because that's when I did experience that surrender. Mm. I was done.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the cliche is to call it rock bottom, and everybody's rock bottom is different. Yeah. But it's, you know, I've heard that moment described before, of that feeling of it's over. My biological mom, Mark, was an alcoholic, and she surrendered custody of me and my brother when I was 7. And she got sober on my 18th birthday. Now, she went on to, she was homeless. She was under a bridge in Chicago. She was beaten really badly and assaulted and left paralyzed. She was in a wheelchair. She kept drinking. And then one day she said she was at a party and there was free beer, and something just hit her, and she asked a friend to take her to the hospital, and she said, I'm an alcoholic and I'm suicidal and I need help. And she fought
so hard for her sobriety. She went to a treatment center and then she said, this is too easy. I know this isn't going to work for me. She could feel herself manipulating it. And so she fought to get into a much harder one, and she stayed sober until she died 7 years ago. Like, she managed to turn it around. And I she's talked to me about that moment, and it the way you described it there is really consistent with her experience. It's just that feeling of, I just can't keep going. And I think it's really important to describe that. Do you think that there would have been a moment, or there was anything that anybody else could have done at any stage, or did it have to be you reckoning with yourself?
It had to be me, and firstly, my condolences. It had to be me, and I think also it's a weird thing that I talk about. And I don't want to bore people with the philosophy of it all, but it does make me worry about the self-centeredness of addiction, but also the self-centeredness of recovery, in the sense that there were lots of people who told me at various times that I needed help, and there were hands extended to me left, right, and center, you know, but until you're ready yourself, it's futile. And it took me needing to hit that. And, you know, the rock bottom, like, I had many other rock bottoms before then where I thought never again. But as in, whatever happened that day, it took me going, I'm fucking done.
Yeah.
And it sort of probably came as a surprise to people around me, that I was like, well, why? Because in their almost eyes, it's like there was nothing particularly profound. It's not like I crashed the car.
Yeah.
I got arrested. I did something, you know, that was at odds or inconsistent with my previous binges. This was just a regular old binge, but it's that internal dereliction where it's just like, I'm done. So no, unfortunately, there was many opportunities for me to reach out and accept help before, but it took me knowing that the jig was up.
Yeah.
And knowing I couldn't outsmart this, and I couldn't outsmart this, I couldn't outrun this, I couldn't outdrink this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's important to say that, because there will be people listening who have loved ones who are addicted at the moment, an active addiction. And I know that struggle, and how much you wish you could do something, anything. But at the end of the day, it has to be the person themselves. That doesn't mean there aren't things that you can do, and you should get yourself support, of course, 100%. But it isn't something that you can solve for another person. And that's why I mentioned all the things that happened for my mom in the interim, because you would think homelessness, you would think being assaulted to the extent that you're paralyzed, you know, and you have to learn to walk again, and then you can't actually. And, you know, she had all of the things that you would tick, that you were saying, well, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not blah, blah, blah. She was all of those things, and none of that was her moment. And the moment came on a day that was completely unexpected. It's such an internal thing. And I obviously haven't experienced it myself, and I'm not an expert, but it was remarkable for me to hear you describe it and think about how consistent that was with her experience as well. Can I ask you, sorry, go on.
No, it's okay. Sorry, continue.
I have friends who are in recovery, and one of the things that they have struggled with is the unfairness of it. The feeling of, why can't everybody else, and it's not everybody else, but like everybody else can just drink normally, why can't I? That like feeling of being unlucky or it being unfair, which I kind of think it is, to be honest, because, you know, why can I have two glasses of wine and someone else can't? It's, you know, it doesn't seem like there's any rhyme or reason in it. Is that a feeling that you've had? And if it is, how do you manage that?
Somebody told me pretty much in my first week of sobriety, you know, why me? Why not me? Why not me? And that extends to every department of life, you know. Why not me? Why? So, like, your mum didn't ask for those. Your biological mother didn't ask for those situations, you know. None of us ask for anything. I consider myself to be lucky. And I am so much to be grateful for. And that sounds generic and sweeping, but I do. I pinch myself with how lucky I am that I managed to get help when I did. Every day of the week, I talk to other people who are still suffering, you know, who are still out there. With that, dealing with that loneliness, that isolation, that angst, that horrendous existential fucking oblivion of just banging your head against the wall and not knowing that there is a life beyond your wildest dreams, beyond, outside of addiction. Mm. And it's like, I absolutely, it's tempting on some occasions to think, oh, why can't I just be like other lads? Why can't I just be like other ladies? Why can't I be like other people and just go out for a drink? And, but I need to slap myself. I don't slap myself as weird. Mm-hmm. I need to shake my, snap myself. That's the word. Yeah. I need to snap myself out of that thinking, mm. because that is, for me, is the most dangerous, but again, alluring thought process ever. Why is Mark like this? But I am so lucky. It's beyond comprehension to be sitting here today, having a conversation with you, to be able to walk downstairs and make a cup of tea. Mm. And like some of the, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but some of the most profound moments of my recovery, and this is certainly consistent with the alcoholics I know, it's not like, you know, necessarily walking out on to do live shows or, you know, going to big events or doing these things. It's like standing in the kitchen with a cup of tea in my hand, looking at the sun come up. And I genuinely have had tears in my eyes going, how is this my life? Mm. How is everything okay? And to not have fires in my mind of, you know, too numerous to mention, that require constant putting out. Mm. And the self-disgust and the agonizing inability to be Mark and to want to inhabit my own body. Like, that is the profound life that I have, that I have. You know, the day that I'm not grateful for that, no matter what happens, by the way, externally, because life is still life, by the way, like shit still happens. And I think because I'm an addict, whenever I first got into recovery, I view, like, my life was just a series of infinite transactions. Everything was for something, no matter what. If I'm meeting Louise for a coffee, she better offer me to go for a drink afterwards, because I want something from her. You know, I'll go under the idea that I'm asking you about work, but I want to get drunk that night, and then I want to go elsewhere. So when I came into recovery, I initially thought as well, bang, if I'm getting this, I must be getting that. Mm. If I'm sacrificing this, I must be gaining that. And staying sober and practicing a program of recovery has taught me just obviously how wrong I was about everything. Mm. And the real beauty of recovery is being able to sleep at night.
Mm.
Been able to live between my ears. Mm. And it's been able to, you know, just get by.
And if someone's listening now and they're struggling, and they're not able to sleep at night, and they are not able to kind of sit with themselves, and they are maybe recognizing themselves in what we've talked about today, what would your recommendation be to them?
Talk to someone. Talk to someone. Just ask for help.
Mm.
And it doesn't need to be an expert on drinking, and it could be, by the way, you know, it could be a doctor, it could be a therapist, it could be there's many numbers that, if you Google, you know, there are many numbers of that you can call free of charge immediately, and an alcoholic will talk to you if that's what you wish. But also, if you're not there yet, if you just want to stop drinking, you know, for me, the label of alcoholism, and we can talk about changing the label and changing the interpretation of alcoholics as a label, but like, I don't care, to be honest.
Mm.
If somebody wants to stop drinking and they can't, there is help out there.
Mm.
If somebody is drinking and their drinking is bringing them to their knees internally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, psychologically, whatever, there is help out there. If you wake up in the morning and all you can think about is this gray, and you're just looking forward, counting down the days to the next drink, like, there is help out there. And I don't, you know, to be brutally honest with you, Louise, like, when I was drinking the way that I was, if I listened to this, would it help? I don't know, because it's impossible to see what's over the wall, if that makes sense. And, you know, I remember reading a book when I was about 7, or no, much, probably 12. I remember reading about a book when I was around 12, nothing about alcoholism, but the protagonist in it described what it must feel like to discover a new color. And it's such a weird thing to think about. Like, imagine trying to think of a new color. Like, you can't. Like, what is a new color?
Yeah.
But that's, for me, is like what sobriety is. It's like, it's not anything I thought it was. It's not anything I'd hoped it would be. It's not anything that I've read about. It is a different, like, I feel like a different person to the one that I was before. Now, I am the same person, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm also, as you know, I just need to repeat it, like, I'm probably saying the same thing I was doing every bit of media around the book, but like, I'm not in recovery to be holier than thou. I'm not better. Yeah. I am not like, I don't have the answers. I am not more virtuous than anybody who's drinking. I'm not more virtuous than other people who don't drink. I am literally just doing this to make life easier and for it to be okay to be me, you know?
Well, it sounds like you are in a really good place.
Thank you.
Is that true? Can you confirm?
Okay. Let me just. I'm so panicking about these questions that in my head I'm like, be careful what you say now.
No, Megan. Don't worry. We're coming to an end now, Mark. So you can take it. Yeah, exhale.
Thank you. I'm sure the listener can feel my shoulders just so tense. Yeah. Look, I'm really happy. Mm. It's strange. I'm a happy person now. I love my life. You know, I'm going to get married. I'm really excited about that. I've got my relationships with everybody are just improving, and not straight away, not all of them immediately, you know. Yeah. Lots of them require conversations and uncomfortable chats about things that have gone on and whatnot. Mm. But the life that I have today is so beautiful, and it sounds like I'm a gushing idiot or like, but it's the part of these conversations that I've lost for words on, because I can't tell you how different it is. I just have like lovely friends, lovely family, and it's okay. Things are fine. That's it. Like it's ups and downs. There's lots of external stress from, you know, work shite and, you know, the aforementioned articles and all that sort of stuff that can get you on bad days. But like, the most important thing is that like, I'm in love with my fiance. I've got some really lovely friends. My relation with my immediate family is just amazing. Yeah. Like, I have people that I will now comfortably text and tell them if I'm having a bad day. Yeah. And most importantly, and I wouldn't want to finish the interview without saying this, it's that I can be there for them when they're having a bad day.
Yeah.
Like, I think the unspoken people in addiction and in recovery very often are the people who are around you, you know? Like, I do an interview and I get Instagram messages from people saying that, you know, you're amazing, well done, or, you know, congrats and you've done so well and stuff. Like, Darren, and forget the fact that Darren is famous, Darren Gary.
Yeah.
If she's just somebody who is in a relationship with a recovering alcoholic who has to work on his recovery every day. She has to put up with it. She has to live with it.
Mm.
You know, she has to live with me on my bad days. And by the way, there are lots of bad days. Like, recovery isn't just one linear, you know, march into the sunset. Yeah. It's not. Like, you know, I have the capacity to be as crazy as I was when I was drinking without the drink. And there are all the people around me, like my good friends, my family, Darren, you know, Darren's family, all of these people who just wrap me up with so much love, like, they deserve the accolades because they're the people that make it easy for me to stay sober.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And that's where my deepest fear would be that like I come across as evangelical or like that I deserve some sort of canonization for getting sober. I'm sober because these people love me enough and they love me enough when I can't love myself.
Mm. Well, I don't think you need to be worried about that. I really don't. That's not how you come across. That's not how the book reads. That's not the vibe that I'm getting in any way from anything that you've said today or from anything I read in the book. I really would recommend the book. It is not a hard read, but I don't want that to sound insulting. Like, it's a compliment as far as I'm concerned. Like, you will find yourself, you'll pick it up and you'll suddenly be 100 pages through it and you'll be like, how did that happen? It is very honest. It is full of hope. And I am full of admiration, Mark. I think it's a really brilliant thing that you've done. And I wish you all the best with the rest of your interviews. I know it's hard. I've done it. Like, I know it's hard. But I think that the net positivity out of this is going to far outweigh any negativity. And I hope that you find that to be the experience as well.
I really appreciate that, Louise. And I'd just like to say you've made me feel so comfortable. And it is tough. And even like when I listen back, like the difference in my disposition when you ask the first question you hear and I'm like so defensive. I'm like, oh no, it's this again.
No,
oh god.
No, I know. I felt bad for asking that question first. But I guess what I wanted to say was that I was coming from a neutral position. I wanted you to believe me when I said that I thought the book was brilliant. But look, this is, we're human beings, Mark. That's the thing. And this podcast is about conversations. It's not about I don't even really consider them interviews. I mean, they are interviews, but they're chats. Yeah. And you know, all of my crew who listen, who are amazing, know that. And I know that they're going to love you for it. So thank you so much.
Thanks,
Mark.
So much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did. Big fan of Mark's, and it was lovely to meet him and chat through all of that stuff. His book is available now. You can get it usual book places. There's a link to Kenny's, who offer free shipping worldwide, in the show notes of this podcast if you want to go and get it. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed talking to him. In terms of recommendations this week, guys, I don't have loads, but what I do have is one that is about 700 years late. And, you know, look, that's just the way of life sometimes. People have been whispering about Last One Laughing on Amazon Prime. I'd heard people say it's very funny and that they really enjoyed it. And I was just kind of like, I don't know. I like comedy, don't get me wrong, but something about like structured comedy programs just kind of put me off. But we started it last week and I really have massively, massively enjoyed it. It is so funny. The premise is that you get a group of Irish comedians in a room and they have to spend 6 hours in that room. And the idea is that they have to not laugh at each other. So the last person who keeps a straight face gets a massive donation for a charity of their choice. Great idea. And Graham Norton is sitting in another room kind of monitoring them. They can't even smile, by the way. Graham's sitting in another room monitoring them as they go to great pains to try and make each other laugh while not laughing themselves. And it is very silly and really fun, and it is well worth it. I think I have so enjoyed it. It's great for, like, you know, we started watching it when we'd been out for the day and we'd had, you know, a couple of glasses of wine and we didn't want to sit down and watch anything serious, or I knew I would just fall asleep if I tried to watch a film or something. You know, in those moments when you want something that's kind of fun or funny or even something kind of musicy, this isn't musicy obviously, but for those moments it's an ideal program. I really loved it. I had to message Tony Cantwell last night to say how brilliant he is on it. He in particular, I think, is just excellent. But they're all good. They are all good. Even there might even be one or two comedians in there who you think, I don't like them. And still, in the context of the program, they're entertaining. So yeah, Last One Laughing. It is there on Amazon Prime if you want to get it. So that's all, my friends. I will talk to you on Monday. I know I have gotten many SOS messages from you guys who please, Louise, I can't wait till Monday. I need someone to explain what is going on. Because obviously, Leah Varadkar resigned yesterday. Well, I think that it's actually better that we're going to wait to talk about it until Monday, because things need to settle. We don't know what's happening yet. As I record, it's 9:30 on Thursday morning. So even tomorrow, we'll have a better idea. And by Monday, sure, we'll know what the story is, I think. And myself and Carl have a good chat about it. So I will talk to you then. Have a great weekend. They can't all be great, so don't worry about it if it's not. Just put one foot in front of the other and we'll get together again on Monday. Thank you to Acast and all my contributors. I will talk to you then.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.